How do you earn a nickname of character assassin? Hi, my name is Marco and welcome to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. My guest this week is Star Z Davis. She is a best-selling author and the winner of numerous book awards, including the Firebird Book Award and Pinnacle Achievement Award. Star rides by the lake, dreaming up new ways to torture her characters. She's best known for her soul-crushing historical fantasy and genre-blending dystopian worlds and fantasy realms. We talked about her new epic fantasy novel Storm Valor that just launched. It marks Star's genre shift from dystopian fiction to epic fantasy, and it's already receiving rave editorial reviews, and was recently honored with a Literary Titan Award. So get comfortable, and let's get into this week's Storyline Session with Star Z Davis. Enjoy! Hi Star, welcome to Storyline Sessions, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing pretty good, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's really exciting talking to you, especially as when we'll be broadcasting this, when people see it, it will be just around the corner from your release. So yeah. We're here to mostly talk about Storm Valor. Of course, we'll touch upon some of the other things you've done, because you've done quite a few, so you're a very prolific writer, and we'll get to that as well.
Yeah, but that word gets thrown around.
Yeah, it figures, but maybe let's start from just like feeling now, because you've done quite a bit of work, but how does this release feel different from stuff you've done before?
I've been doing a whole lot more promotional stuff for this one before the release. Like, I actually had a Kickstarter campaign that I ran at the very beginning of the year to do a special edition of the book, and I'm still waiting for the books. They should be arriving at my doorstep any day. But so I got a lot of new readers from that, and I've been, you know, trying to get way more ARC readers for the book to try to get more people in the door to kick this series off. I think that it's going to be very different from some of the stuff that I've done before, but the marketing has been quite a change from what I've done in the past.
Yeah, it's kind of an unavoidable topic when I talk to most of the authors, because a lot of us are still doing the marketing ourselves. So how's that side for you? I know that you've gotten, like, as you said, more active in that department, but like, how does that look and how much of your time actually goes towards that instead of, you know, creating the stories?
Well, right now, it's been pretty much all of my time. I haven't been doing any writing right now. I've been focusing just strictly on the marketing for this book, because I feel like it's really important for the first book to come out of the gates as strong as I can make it. I do have the second book written, so, you know, the series is moving along. It's with my beta readers, and it should be with my editor very soon as well. So, it's, yeah.
And when we talked about the interview off camera, you also mentioned that the first reactions are good, so I can imagine you're happy with that. But how do you like respond generally to better readers and talking with editors before everything wraps up? How, let's say, stubborn are you with some of the ideas that maybe they challenge, and how far off is the final product from that?
Yeah, so Storm Valor is actually really interesting. I thought that I had a really cool ending for the book, and then when I gave it to my beta readers, most of them didn't agree. They were not satisfied with how some of the characters parted ways at the end of the book. So I went back through and I was like, okay, if you're willing to answer a few more questions, right? Like, what is it exactly that you were looking for from these characters? And so I took their feedback, and a lot of them said something that was kind of similar. And so I took their feedback, and I actually ended up writing an entirely new ending for the book. And I think that in the long run for the series, that ending is going to be much better than the ending that I originally had, because the original ending had one of my main characters, Ethan, was kind of stuck in this. He would have been stuck in place, and that wouldn't have worked well for everything that he needed to do in the second book. So it worked out well that rewriting the ending moved him out of that, and now he was able to do everything that he was supposed to do in the second book.
And how, like, let's say for this book, but in general, like, you already said you have the second book in place. How do you feel about, like, trying to separate the first one? Like, when you're thinking about it, you already have, like, things that are in motion for the sequels, and now, as you said, you've changed the ending. So how hard is it to, like, stay away from changing that? How does that work for you?
So I take a lot of the feedback that people give me. If they're taking the time to give me the feedback, I think that it's my responsibility to take that feedback seriously, just because they obviously had strong enough feelings to express them to me directly. With this ending for Storm Valor, it doesn't really affect anything. In fact, like I said, the change in the ending, I think, is going to make it stronger going into the next books. But there is sometimes feedback that I get from people where I have to think about the long term, right? Like, if I were to take that feedback, how is that going to affect the series in the long run? And so sometimes I can't take that advice because I'm like, well, I can't really do that because if I do that, then this thing that's supposed to happen later isn't going to be possible. So it's a process.
Yeah, for sure. And writing series for you, how do you like balance out wanting to tell like a single story contained within a book, but also making it part of something bigger? Because you don't get like a lot of people who have multiple series who aren't thinking about the next book. Of course, it's difficult to be self-contained because it isn't a standalone. But still, right. How do you balance out your endings not to go too much in just teasing different things in the future? I know right. That like actually for TV, that's like the best example. People often like complaining about series that are basically set up for the next season. So how do you avoid that?
So I don't really. I try to make sure that the things that happen in the book are, those ends are all tied off as much as possible in that book. But I make it very clear that it's leading into something else at the end also. So there's a cliffhanger, but at the same time, there's not, because a lot of the things that happen in the first book are nicely tied up together. Could you read it as a standalone? The first book, probably. The rest of the books, probably not.
Yeah, that makes sense. And with your experience with past series, what did change for Storm Valor? I can imagine, like, as you build on the things you've done in the past, you get some things that work and some things that don't. But as you're changing genres, we'll talk about that as well. What are some things that, like, you know, these are set from the start that you did before, and now what's changing in the process?
So from, like, the writing that I was doing before and moving into this more epic fantasy style?
Yeah.
So I feel like, so I was writing dystopian fiction before, and while the worlds are kind of constructed different, they're built different, I still feel like there's a lot of crossover between how you can write that kind of fiction versus how you can write fantasy, because it's still all the land of make-believe, right? Except my dystopian books were grounded in some alternate universe version of our world, whereas this one is not. So it gives you a little bit more freedom, actually, to be able to explore. I'm not as tied down to, well, this place would be so far away from this place, right? And readers who read this book are going to know that because they know where this place and this place are. Where, I mean, I have my map, but there's a little bit more flexibility as far as those kinds of things go. As far as the world building goes, I don't think that there's really that big of a difference. You're still building, even with dystopian fiction, you're still building a new world, even if it's grounded in our world.
Yeah, and keeping that in mind, still, it is a switch, so how did it come by? When was the moment you decided, like, okay, I should actually try venturing out to this different genre? Was it something that, like, you've always wanted to do? Is it something so spontaneous when you came by this story? So how did it go through?
So I've been a big fan of epic fantasy for a long time. I mean, I started reading the Wheel of Time series way back in the day, and got really into Dragonlance when that was really hot and popular. So I've always been into, like, the sword and sorcery epic fantasy worlds, and I actually started building this world when I was in, like, my very early 20s, so it was a long time ago, and I just couldn't quite get the story right in my head, and so I kept having to, like, push it off, because I couldn't figure out exactly what it was that, like, I had the characters and I had the world, but it was the story itself that I couldn't quite get to move in the right direction. And I did struggle with that for years. So this has always been, it's always been on the back burner for me. I always knew that I was going to come back to it. And I'm actually super excited about making this shift. I feel like there's a lot of crossover between some of the stuff I've written before and this. I mean, there are going to be some people who aren't going to cross over because my dystopian books were young adult and these are not. And You know, some people who read dystopian fiction are not into fantasy, and all of these things are okay. It's going to go the other way, too, if people discover me through this fantasy series and want to go back and look at my backlist. They may not be as interested in some of the stuff I've done before, but I feel like I'm grounding myself in fantasy now, and that's the direction I see myself going for the foreseeable future.
And making the shift from YA to adult, was that challenging for you? I can imagine that, like, you need to go through things, something that, like, maybe comes to mind when you've done a lot of YA, and then you're like, okay, this needs to change. So yeah. How did that look like?
So I've always been a very character-driven writer, and I feel like as long as I understand that particular character and their motivations and I'm really with them, that when it comes to the writing part of it, it didn't feel like a big shift to me. Because when I was writing YA, I was thinking from the character's point of view, I was with them, so the things that happen to them and the ways that they react are very different from the ways that, you know, more adult characters are going to react. So I feel like that foundation was kind of already there for me. But there are some things that, you know, without going too much into details, I mean, there are some scenes that are very intense in this book, and it's only going to get, you know, worse or better, depending on perspective, I guess, as the books go on. So, yeah, I feel like I made the shift pretty well. I'm hoping that some of my readers from the dystopian fiction, I have a lot of adult readers who read it too. I'm kind of hoping that they'll make the shift. My daughter's disappointed because she's 13 and she read all of my dystopian books. And now she's like, what do you mean I can't read this one? And I'm like, yeah, I'm not comfortable with it. There are things that happen in this that I'm just not comfortable with crossing that bridge with you yet.
So the trend of you putting your characters through malice is continuing with this one as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've gotten like a nickname. I think that's something that's probably asked a lot, but we need to mention it, like character assassin. Yeah. Please do tell about that.
Yeah, so came off as a joke at first when I was in my undergrad, and I was going through the program for publishing and creative writing, and so I was taking a lot of creative writing style classes, and I had the same professor for a few different classes, and she got to a point where she was like, how come all of your characters die? I'm like, well, I mean, I don't do it on purpose. It's just, you know, I go in the direction the story takes me. If that's where the story needs to go, that's where the story needs to go. Not everybody dies. So, yeah, it kind of stuck after that she was like, you're the character assassin, right? You just enjoy killing people. And I was like, I don't enjoy it. If it works for the story, it works.
And being a character-driven writer, how does it feel like sometimes I can imagine you can get attached to your characters. How does that feel like when you feel that it's moment to let them go?
It's really hard to let go. I had a really hard time with my first series letting go. In fact, that's why I wrote the second series. So the first series that I wrote was my dystopian young adult fiction, and I fell so in love with the main character of the book. Like, he was just so fun and really smart. Like, I don't know how I wrote him because he's smarter than me. I loved him so much that I was like, okay, well, I'm not ready to let go. I ended up writing the next series, which was his kids. So in the first one, it's kind of all contained to this one city. And in the second series, they go beyond the borders and kind of explore whatever is left of the world. And so it's his two kids who are telling the story instead. And so he has a couple of cameos in the series where he shows up, but it's mostly them. And I had an even harder time letting go of the characters in that one, like all of them. I loved all of them so much that when it was time to finish the series, I wasn't ready. And so I ended up writing a few kind of short stories. They're not super short. They're probably more like novellas. And it was from the point of view of princes. that were in that series who we don't get to spend as much time with them, and I wanted to explore their characters more, and so I wrote their stories. And then when I finished with that, I was like, I'm still not ready to let go yet. Like, I couldn't let go of this world. And I ended up writing origin stories for three of the other side characters that were in the first series. And after that, I was like, I'm done. I have to be done, right? Like, at some point, you gotta let go. And I was like, but I need something else to focus on. And so I figured it was a good time to make that shift and throw myself into fantasy instead, and to revisit this world that I had created years ago. But in the midst of all of that, I also wrote a Mongolian historical fiction that is kind of like a fantasy, but that one I had a really hard time letting go of the characters too. And I had a really hard time writing some of their stories because the characters, you know, their stories were already written. It was all based off of real people. And so knowing how some of them were going to end was really hard for me because I was growing so attached to them as I was writing the books, knowing already how it was going to end for them. And it was probably just as heartbreaking for me as it was for some of the readers who got to that point and they were like, no. I definitely had a weekend where I had to I finished a chapter for that series and it was so emotional for me. Then when I wrapped up the chapter, I was like, that's it. I'm not touching anything until Monday. I'm walking away. I need to take the weekend to detox after that.
That sounds crazy because, you know, when you manage to do that to yourself, that you're writing the story, that you know that it's going to stick with the right readers. So it's great that you managed to do that because a lot of times I talk to people and it's like increasingly difficult to surprise yourself as a writer and to, whether it be to elicit emotion being sad or if you're writing horror, to scare yourself. And when you get that spot, I think that's going to resonate with the readers.
Yeah, I hope so.
And talking about characters, who's the POV or POVs for the new novel, like, and the new series? How did you choose them?
So I had, Ethan was always going to be, like, the star of the show. He was the first character that I created for this world when I was in my 20s. So it was always going to be his rodeo. But it wasn't long after I created him that I created Bast, who is the assassin in the series. So it's Ethan, who is the nephew of a king of one of the kingdoms. And Bast, who is this assassin that nobody knows who he really is. He has a very, very carefully created network of brokers who do all the dealings for him, and he just has to show up and do the job and get paid. And then there's Aslan, who she kind of came along later. I wasn't aware that she was going to be as big of a character as she ended up being when I first created this world. But she's a big part of the story. And so the first book kind of focuses on the three of them and how the three of them meet each other and kind of come together and the paths that they end up choosing for themselves at the end of the book that kind of set the course for where they're going for the rest of the series.
And you already know their paths for the rest of the series?
I do.
Is it always the case, or...?
It is for the main characters. Sometimes for the side characters, I have no idea until it happens. Yeah, for the main characters, it is.
And what's your system for keeping track of it all? Because as you've written a couple series and you've written multiple things like simultaneously, what's your system for that, for sorting out? Like the paths do figure out their way.
I have a notebook that actually on the front of it, the notebook is called Organized Chaos, and that's where I keep all of my notes for everything. So it is kind of organized, but it is also kind of chaos. So it's an appropriate name for the notebook.
Sure.
But that's where I keep my notes for everything. Like if somebody makes a comment about how, you know, this person had this kind of tendency that they noticed, I have to make a note of it on their character page so that I don't forget it and I don't have to dig through books later to try to find it. I can just be like, wait, it was this person. What was it? Okay, there it is. And then I can go back to work. So I do have a system for it. It's not perfect and I'm sure there's probably more efficient ways, but it's working for me.
Nah, that's the most important thing. And as for the world building, we discussed a bit earlier about like changing you made dystopian worlds, now this one, but still it's world building. The elements do tend to be similar, but is it something that kind of goes later on because you figure out the characters and the stories and then you think about the world that is going to be set in, or?
So I actually, for this one, I had the world before I had the characters. But then as I was, like, replanning when I picked it back up, you know, to start writing it again this last year, I ended up redrawing the entire map. So I had the same basic cities and their same basic cultures, but everything got rearranged and moved around. And so nothing is where it was, but I needed to move it because of where the characters, I had started planning out the characters' story arcs, and I was like, well, I can't have this place exist here because it's not going to work for the story for the character. And so figured I should probably hammer all of that out before I actually started writing the first book, so that everything was kind of set and ready to go. I won't have that kind of wiggle room as I go along, right? Once the book is published, the map is out there, and that's that.
Yeah, it would be interesting, like, figuring out when everything is out, like, okay, these places don't align. How many times do you go through the map? Like, how does that process work? Because for me, it's always interesting hearing about people and maps. I know it's kind of one of the staples of fantasy, and for me, it's really awesome when a book has a map. I know not a lot of authors can do that, but when I see it, it kind of already lifts my mood, even though I haven't read a page. So what's your relation to maps?
I always try to include them. I didn't for my first dystopian series because it was all one city, and I didn't, although in hindsight, looking back, there's like 5 different sections of the city, and I probably could have like made that a little clearer on a map for somebody, but it was all one city, so I didn't bother with a map. But then when I did the second series, because they were leaving, I had like the map of the United States, but it was like broken down into radioactive areas on the actual map. And it showed where certain places that these characters go are at. So I wasn't like an extensive map of the US, but it had like the key points that people would need to know for the series. And then for this one, it's a big map. It's a big world, and I'm only showing a fraction of it on this map because it's the only part that's going to matter for this series. But I expect that I'll be writing, once I finish this, I'll probably be writing another series in this world, but it's going to be in a different part of the world.
And how many iterations of the map you went through?
Probably 3 or 4.
And was it like when you put it down straight away, was it like fine-tuning? Did you were happy with whatever it looked, or you kind of go get something from scratch? How did that go?
So it was more fine-tuning than starting over. So like the first map, the original map that I had, I did kind of start over from that one. And did something very different. The only thing that stayed was the names of the cities, because I loved them so much. But even those are not in the same place, not even close to the same place that they were on that original map. It's just the name, and that's it. But after that, it was kind of just shifting things around. And like, okay, well, I have this river over here, but it doesn't make sense. So I'm going to take it and I'm going to move it over here, because the characters are going to need this river later to be able to do this thing. So I needed to go in this direction. Just like little tweaks like that, just shifting a few things around here and there until I finally had it sorted out.
And speaking of names, do you got any tips for like juggling and coming up with consistent names? What's your method for that?
I don't really have a good method for that. I think that Athen's name it's a scrambled up version of Athena. So there's going to be some correlation there that people who pay attention are going to notice. Not that he has anything to do strictly with Athena, but there'll be some relations that people will see. And Bast's name actually originally was different, and I had to change his name because when I wrote his name originally was Dayan, and when I wrote my Mongolian fiction with all of the names of people who actually existed, there was a Dayan, and I was like, I can't do that. I can't do that in 2 different series. I have to change his name. So I actually went on TikTok and I was like, so here's the problem. Help me solve this problem. And I let people just post in the comments and give me ideas. And I kind of picked through them from there.
Nice. That's a good way to engage with people who like your work.
Yeah.
And now that we, like, when we have this image, like, of the new series and everything, when you said that you have second book in place already, I have to ask, like, the timing of everything, because you started publishing the first series, like, 5 years ago or something like that.
Yep.
So how does that check out? Please let us know what's the secret.
The secret is that my husband is kind enough to say, hey, you do this, I can take care of all of this, right? So I don't have to try to hold down a job while I'm doing this. This is my job. And so I get to have all day, well, my kids are off at school and my husband is off at work, and I sit down at the computer and that's my time to shine. So that's probably why I can write at a faster rate than some other people can, is because I have unlimited time to do it.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense, but still the pace is really, really good. I mean, still a lot of people do to take some time to get started, and like, I think that you managed to, okay, this is something I do, this is basically now a job, and to power through it, still it's commendable, even though it is like primarily the thing that you do. Still, I think that a lot of people just get stuck, especially when they have like larger projects in mind.
Right, I got stuck too, you know. It's not all smooth gears in motion. I have those days too. I had started book two in October, I think. It was like late October, and I was like, I'll have this thing hammered out by Christmas time, because it usually takes me about 2 months to get through the first draft of the book. But I didn't account for the holidays and everything else that happens through the course of November and December. And I ended up getting zero writing done throughout those 2 months. And then January rolled around, and we were in our house, we were in recovery mode from the holidays. And then I ended up getting sick, and I was down and out for like 2 weeks. It was just awful. And so I didn't get to really start writing the second book until February. But again, you know, it takes me about 2 months to get through it once I have time to sit down and just power through it. I work on my books Monday through Friday, during normal business hours. So when, you know, everybody else is at school and at work, I'm at my computer writing, and I go anywhere from, some of my worst days are like maybe 2,000 words, and some of my best days are around 10,000. I don't have very many of the 10,000 days. I would say my average is probably around 3 to 4.
Yeah, that still sounds good. And thinking about, like, now maybe not the trend, but it's still a tendency that a lot of indie authors, and generally in the space of fiction, fantasy, sci-fi, people now gravitate towards like longer series that are fairly fast-paced. And I've seen a lot of people who just like pump out insane amount of writing. And do you go with like something that's, okay, I need this time to finish it, and you set your like own schedule for that? Or does sometimes like the pressure of the, it's not a great word, but like market and people that are writing things around you, does that get to you sometimes?
It does sometimes. You know, everybody suffers from imposter syndrome. I'm definitely no outlier. There are times when I watch some of my other author friends who seem to be doing much better and much more than me, and it makes me wonder what it is that I'm doing wrong. If I'm doing this full time, where am I going wrong when they're not doing it full time? But I can only do so much, right? Like, I have my own limits, and I have to keep to my limits. So I try to keep myself in check, but it's hard not to look at what other people are doing and say, why can't I do that?
Yeah, but still, for that imposter syndrome, I can imagine that it helps that you got some recognition formally, like you got some awards. So I can imagine that helps. So you could maybe talk about that experience, like getting those awards and that kind of recognition. Of course, I'm sure that even though that's not like something you primarily do for that, you're not writing to get awards. But still, how did that look like for the first one, and now like when you've gotten a couple of them, how does that look for you?
So the first one that I got was for the Fractured Empire books, actually. That one ended up, it won the Pinnacle Book Achievement Award for like outstanding historical fiction, and I was like over the moon, right? Like, I had poured so much into that to try to get the story right while also telling an engaging story, and to have it validated felt really good. And it still sells really well. Like, the books have been out for 3 years, I want to say, and it's still doing really well. It's probably doing well than any of my other ones. But, and it also ended up shortlisted for the Page Turner Awards. I didn't end up making it to the final round, but it's still like that extra little bit of validation. With the first book in the Powers Legacy series, that one won a Firebird Award for young adult fiction, and again, it felt really good to just have the validation, right? Like, who wouldn't be happy to have some awards committee say this is really amazing? And you know, the same thing with Storm Valor, when that one won the Literary Titan Award. And again, it just felt really good. And they called it, like, I'm trying to remember the exact words, and I'm probably not going to remember the exact words, but they basically said that it was, like, had a really strong foundation for what's to come in the series.
And how did that come about? Because the book is technically not yet out formally. How does that go about, like, getting it in front of the people who do that? Because I wasn't familiar with awards before.
So there's a bunch of them out there. I kind of weed through them myself and try to find things where I think that the book might make a good fit. It's Storm Valor is still out for several other ones that are still in the process of weeding through all of their entries, and so I probably won't be done with the awards for that one until the end of the year. I just did the search and tried to weed through some of the more reputable ones, you know, the ones that I've seen other authors go through, and people that I know, right? Not just like random authors, but people that I know who have submitted to these contests and done well. And I made my own list and just submitted the book to a bunch of them.
Yeah, and speaking of other authors, you mentioned a couple that you've become friends with a couple of people, and you know people who are authors as well. For you now, like, looking back, the importance of community is of course large, but what are some like key points that you would point out that were, I won't say possible, but like enhanced by being a part of the community?
They're very good at helping me when I need help. Like, for this book, I had been on like 2 podcasts before, a couple of times, and I had a friend who is an author who had his own podcast, and so I reached out to him, and I was like, do you have any idea on who else I might contact? Like, I don't even know how to search for this kind of thing, because there's so many podcasts out there. And so he was kind enough to, he sent me this list, and he's like, well, these are all the people that I've contacted. Some of them I had luck with, and some of them I didn't, and so I went through that list myself and reached out. So having him to be able to help, you know, makes a difference. Having some of these authors who are just as excited about my new books as I am about theirs. And so there's a whole lot of like swapping books that goes on to help each other out with reviews when the books launch, and, you know, sharing information about good artists, whether it's cover artists or just like character art. You know, all of those things. I come across those things from other authors that I talk to. It's not just me searching around and throwing a dart at the wall.
Yeah, of course. You mentioned character art. That was one of the topics I also wanted to talk about, because as we've mentioned, you're quite character driven. So coming by right art is really important to emphasize those characters. And how picky are you about that? And what's your process about getting the right art for it?
I'm probably too picky. There were some artists that were recommended to me, and then when I went and looked at some of the other stuff that they've done, I'm like, yeah, it's not for me. It's not that the art was bad, it just didn't feel like it was gonna be to my taste for these books. And so it's kind of important to have an understanding of what it is that you're hoping for and looking for. The cover artist that I ended up with, so the special edition has one cover, and the wide release has a different cover, and there's 2 different artists that I had for them. And the special edition one She is another author, and I actually came across her on Kickstarter, and it wasn't through her campaign, it was somebody else who had her art in it, and I saw the art, and I was like, that's amazing, that's what I'm looking for. And so I reached out to her, and we did three different pieces for that special edition. There was the cover piece, and then the two other characters, so I ended up with all three of the main characters. And then I wanted the wide release to have a different cover so that that Kickstarter edition felt, you know, a little bit more special to the people who supported it. And I reached out to another author and I was like, I really love the cover of your book. Where did you get the art for it? And he sent me information. He's like, well, it's this person. And I looked at her Instagram account and I was like, this stuff is so awesome. And so I reached out to her and she did the cover for the first book. And she's actually... right now, she has all of the information she needs to start the cover for the second one, too. So I'm really excited to see what she comes up with for that one.
That's awesome. And how much input did you give? Like, what's your brief for the art?
Well, they have characters on them. So obviously, you know, a good understanding of who the character is and what they look like kind of sets the tone for it. I try to make it... I want it to feel like it's part of the world in that book. But at the same time, I don't want it to be like a snip, like somebody took a picture from, you know, if it was live action and somebody took a picture of it. I want it to kind of just encapsulate the feel of the book. So the cover for the first one, I actually have it right here. So this one, and it actually goes all the way onto the back here. You got the sword in the puddle of blood on the ground to kind of
nice. Again,
setting the mood. There's no scene where this lightning is happening. So, spoilers, sorry everybody. It doesn't happen, but it is important to the story. And so again, I wanted to make sure that those things came across in the cover.
Yeah, but no lightning's included.
No, there's some storms, but there's no actual... There's lightning that's hinted at, but nothing that like comes down like that in the arena. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, but it's still evocative. It looks good. And speaking of Kickstarter, we need to talk about your experience with that, like from the side of results, obviously, but also with the process of getting it all together, because I've listened to one of your interviews where you talked a bit about that, and I think that's quite a kind of important thing for people who are thinking about doing their own projects, hearing about like all the things that go into that, because it's kind of tough seeing from the outside what do you need to do to put successful projects like that to come together.
So... again, finding a community, right, that makes a big difference. I did not do that when I started on Kickstarter, and I didn't realize that the community existed until I reached out to another author whose campaign I had supported, and it was running at the same time as mine. And I was like, hey, do you want to do this swap so we can share each other's information with our readers? And she's like, yeah, you know, there's this group on Facebook that does this. And so there's... and it turned out they do way more than that. It's not just about swapping with each other, but they share information about, you know, printing companies for the books and for artwork, and you can get feedback, and just a community makes a huge difference. And listening to the feedback, sometimes it can be a little bit hard. They're not trying to be harsh. They're just being open and honest about it. But sometimes when you have your heart set on something and they're like, yeah, that may not work, it's really hard to let go, which happened to me with one of them. I wanted to do this, like, huge, beautiful box set of the entire Powers universe. So it was, like 13 books. But the funding goal for it was ridiculously high, because we're talking about 13 books with a slipcase and everything. You know, it's not cheap. And they're like, well, that might be a little bit high. You're going to have a really hard time funding at that level. I was like, well, but I've already put all this work into it, right? And I was like, well, I've already put the work into it. Let's just see what happens. And it ended up, they were right. I ended up falling just barely short, which was kind of heartbreaking. But it didn't work out. And so I was like, well, back to the drawing board, right? I want to do something for it. But so, yeah, community is important. Having realistic expectations, you know, if you are new to Kickstarter and it's your first time putting a campaign out there and you set your funding goal at like $3,000, $5,000, odds are you're not going to get there. Whereas some of the more seasoned people who have been through it several times, are more likely to get there because they have already established themselves in the community. They've established trust with people who have supported them in the past. So they're more likely to reach some of those higher funding goals. It's not that it's impossible, it's just unlikely. So realistic expectations and understanding that people are looking for books, right? So doing something for like a special ebook or audiobook or paperback even, they don't do nearly as well. They're a lot more likely to be set up for failure than a hardcover is. So there's actually a lot that goes into it. It's a very visual platform. So images, lots of images.
Yeah, and like when you figured out, okay, this was kind of maybe too much, but still like wanted to do that slipcase and everything, how passionate are you generally about like those things and like special editions? I think that's something that's really on the rise for the last couple of years, and I think it's really noticeable.
Yeah, I think so too. Like if you look at my shelf back here, I've got all kinds of special editions. Some of them are mine and some of them are not. Just, I really like the pretty books just like everybody else does. So I have a tendency to pick up those pretty books, you know, if I can afford them. And I think that you're right. Like those things are kind of on the rise. Even if you go to a bookstore these days, they have a special section that's set aside that just has these kinds of books, right? Mm. That have all of the pretty things on them. And honestly, when I go into the bookstore, that's the first place I go.
Yeah, it makes sense. But audiobooks are also quite popular. Me personally, I can't get that much into them because it's really tough, like not doing anything else. But when I do anything else, I tend to like space out. So it's really tough, even though I know it's good for people who need help with accessibility and just like people who can't do it the other way. But for me, it's not something I really got into, but I know it's huge. So what's your experience with that?
Personally, as a listener to audiobooks, I agree with you, and I also don't agree with you. I think that it depends on the book. So there are plenty of books that I have listened to, and I still own the books, but like the Imperium series, the Fourth Wing, had those. I got those on audiobook and listened to the audiobooks of those, and they were kind of easy for me to listen to while I was, you know, going shopping at the grocery store or mowing the yard or, you know, just doing tasks with my earbuds in. And because you're always in the same character's point of view and you have the same cast of characters, not a whole lot changes, and it's very easy to follow. That was not the case with Brandon Sanderson's Way of Kings. I was trying to do that while I was doing yard work outside. Like you said, you know, sometimes you kind of phase out and lose focus on listening because you're focused on what you're doing. And I couldn't keep track of what was going on in that audiobook. I didn't know who was who. I didn't know where anybody was. I didn't know what was going on. I ended up totally lost. And I was like, all right, I have to read this one. I can't listen to this book. But yeah, so it really just depends on the book, I think. As an author, I have a love-hate relationship with audiobooks. I love hearing a narrator produce my writing into the spoken word, especially when it's done really well, right? Like they're giving life to something that I created, and it feels really awesome. But at the same time, the cost of creating an audiobook is really high, and you have to make sure that there's some way that you can return your investment on the books. So I have a love-hate relationship with it. Like, I love having them done, but the budgeting for them is the hardest part.
And do you think that it kind of gets the return on investment? Like, if it does well, do you think it's worth doing it?
Honestly, I have not really seen a return on investment on any of mine. I don't regret doing it. I still feel very passionate about them, and I think that the narrators did a fantastic job of narrating the books, and so it's not that I regret doing it. It takes a long time to get the return on investment back on audiobooks.
Now, I think that a lot of things are slowly moving to like getting different platforms that you can put them on, and slowly but surely shifting away from the huge players. We all know who is running the game, but I think that it's really interesting seeing in the like next couple of months, years, what will happen, because I know I've heard like talks about some different platforms trying to do more fair deals for authors and things like that. So hopefully we'll get somewhere with that. And like, speaking of that, how do you feel about like differences in now all the different methods in publishing, and did you think about like changing the way you do things now for this series, or are you set in your ways for that?
I try to keep myself flexible, but it's also very easy for, you know, anyone to slide back into old habits. I don't know. I guess I'm having a hard time with some of the changes. Like, there's the AI. I don't want to dig too much into it because it's a huge topic and it would be an entire conversation, but I try my best to avoid it. And there have been times that I've been accused of using AI in my art. And there is some stuff that, like, I think that some of the images that I probably use in my TikTok videos, they might have been AI generated. I don't know. I usually pull stuff from like Pinterest or, you know, other sites. So it's hard to tell, but when it comes to what I'm selling to people, if I am charging them for it, then I should be paying to have another artist, you know, doing the actual art. I have strong feelings about that, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. But I think that like it can have like different degrees of it. As you said, you're charging people for something and you're creating something yourself. But still, like concept arts, like so just some things that can be used to just showcase something you're working on. I think that people may be too harsh on, especially on people who are like doing things themselves and like doing the promos themselves. I think as long as you're not like fooling anyone and like charging for something that you just typed in a few words and got it.
Yeah, no, that's that. I'm not. Yeah, that's questionable and very,
yeah.
I'd be very turned off if that was me, right? Like if I bought a book by an author and I found out that I may not be as hard on them about the cover, I probably would still feel duped by it, but I wouldn't be as hard on them about the cover. But if I found out that there was AI used in the creation of the text, I'd be livid.
Yeah, I recently saw in a bookstore here in Belgrade, actually, a book that was AI generated. I'm not sure about, like, was it 100%, but still, the artwork, because it's, like, basically, it's not non-fiction, but it's something that was, like, if not mistaken, with something with going to, like, car concepts and something retro-futuristic. And it kind of, even though I'm not, like, a huge car guy, it was, like, very appealing, and I took the book to see it, to like, take a look at it. And at first glance, it didn't seem like that, but when I read, I at least they had a disclaimer in like a prologue or whatever, but as I've realized, it's mostly AI just curated. Basically, this person was a curator, so it's really interesting seeing that in a real bookstore, not just online.
That is interesting. Again, it's AI is a whole other conversation.
Yeah, of course.
Rabbit hole for hours.
I know. Let's not get there now. But still, it's hard to miss out in any conversation. But still, I think that as a contrast to that, you have people with like real voices, and even though it's like a huge competition, a lot of people are creating, as you said, nice books. And I think that like audiences, especially with that and knowing that is present, still go towards people who really have their own voice. And right. I think you like with now with those series and with this new one, even though we've talked about maybe not all of the people crossing over to a new genre, still I think you have an audience. And like, how's that been feeling for you like over the years, like slowly building up the people who really do like your work and who tend to like be there for you? I know, I mean, obviously it's amazing having fans, but like people who really understand what you want to do. How was it like getting to that point to getting in front of the eyes of right people?
So it's definitely a learning curve, right? And that goes back into the marketing again, which is a huge deal for any indie author. Like if you're not working towards marketing your books, you're probably not going to see a whole lot of success. But I struggled hard with the first book. When Ordinary came out, I had scheduled a bunch of like in-person events with libraries and local bookstores, and it came out in March of 2020. So it was right when the pandemic hit and everything shut. And I was like, well, my book just released. Now what do I do? And I was like completely lost. And so it was kind of a trial by fire for me. I reached out to a company that does like book tours, right? Like they organize book tours. And I was like, can you help me with this? And so, you know, that helped me get in front of some readers. And that first series is still doing very well. It does better than the second series, which kind of breaks my heart a little bit. I've done something right. I had to learn how to do like Amazon ads, which is an intense beast. Just trying to figure it out without screwing up. And I tried Facebook ads and they didn't really work out for me. I think that maybe it wasn't the right audience for that book. So I might try it again with the fantasy series because I see a lot of other fantasy series doing them successfully on Facebook. So, but it all comes back to the marketing. You know, you have to get out there and market the book to find the audience. They're not just going to miraculously show up. You might get lucky and get a few, but you're not going to find your readers if you're not out there finding your readers.
And now as you're starting this new series, it's in a way like first because you're changing genre, but now with that experience and the learning curve, what are some things that you would do differently if you started the first series? Like if you didn't have all the backlog, what would you do differently now?
If I was doing this as the first series or?
Yeah, if you haven't got all the ones in the backlog.
What would I do different? I don't know. I don't know that I would. I feel like it's just, again, it's about getting in front of the readers. I try to be active on social media. I'm not nearly as active as other people because I find social media overwhelming. It becomes a lot, and there's so many different platforms now, right? It's not just Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. It's now Instagram has their own kind of version of X where that's the threads, right? The Instagram threads. And then there's like the Blue Sky, which is supposed to be the replacement for, you know, the artist formerly known as Twitter. And there's Lemonade, which is like an offshoot of TikTok, I guess. There's so many of them. And keeping up with all of that, that's like a full-time job. And I don't have the bandwidth to be able to do that and still do my writing. And so I try to post when I can. But there'll be like periods of just silence from me because my focus is on writing the book and not on the marketing, which is probably really bad. But I get a lot of social anxiety when it comes to social media and I have a hard time with it.
It's understandable, but at least, yeah, you're writing, but if something comes out of it, it's not like you're not getting the work done, so... Right. It's not like maybe a lot of people are like the opposite, like I'm too much on the socials, I need to be writing more.
I scroll through them plenty. It's just I get overwhelmed by like, what do I do? What is anyone even going to care about, right? Like finding a way to engage with people in a way that they're even going to want to engage with anything that I have to say or do. It's overwhelming.
I totally get it, but I think that like now with all of those things like being so huge and so many options out there, I think that like being yourself and posting at your own pace, the right people will be there for it, even though the algorithms are doing their best to hide it from people. I think that still like people will be there for it. It's better than to have like a video every day, even though you don't have anything to say to people, at least in my opinion.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree with that. At least I know that what I'm posting is more organic to the way that I'm feeling at the time that I'm posting it, right? It's not like I'm just throwing stuff out there to get attention.
Exactly. I think that people can recognize that, so that's always good in my opinion. And yeah, before I let you go, let's go to like some timelines for this series. What are some huge plans, like not just like something that's already set in motion, you have the second one, but like let's go all out. What do you see for this series going forward?
So... my plan for the series is probably going to be 6 books. If everything kind of pans out the way that I'm hoping it will, I expect it'll be about 6 books. And my timeline between each one is probably going to be somewhere between 6 months to a year. It kind of just depends on life versus my ability to find the time to write. But there's a lot of really good things coming in this series, and I can't, like, the first book is just kind of dipping people's toes in the water and saying, here are the most important people. Now you know them, and they know each other, and you have a basic grasp of the world. And after that first book, things are just going to go everywhere. Like, the second book, there's three new POV characters in the second book, and they don't have a huge part, but the part that they do play is very important to the foundation of the overall story arc for the series. Yeah, so somewhere between 6 months to a year, and I plan on doing a Kickstarter campaign with a special edition with, like, character art and hopefully some battle art in the special edition books on Kickstarter. I'm planning on doing the cover reveal and the title reveal for the second book. Should be coming shortly after the first one comes out. I've been holding on to the title of it so hard, trying not to share it, because I want people to discover the first book first and get their toes in the water with the series. So I'm really excited for the direction that this is going, and I hope that I will have a lot of people jumping on board with me.
That's great. I think that it shows. So it's really nice, like, hearing an author being so passionate about their works, and I think people will pick up on that. So it's exciting. I'm looking forward to it. And yeah, we'll be keeping tabs on everything that happens, sharing the links and following through. So thanks a lot, Star, for coming on to Storyline Sessions. It's been a pleasure. Yeah. And it's exciting seeing what you're going to do next. So we'll be in touch definitely.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find Star using the links below. And if you're interested in storytelling in any kind of media, keep following the Storyline Sessions, both here and on Instagram. My name is Marco, and I'll see you next time. Keep creating stories.